Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sara Gone Rogue with me, Sara Gone. And here we look at an hour's worth on all aspects or any aspects of politics. And as you know, my mantra is that pretty much everything is politics. And today we'll be looking at the newsreaders stole my nurse's story, and I think summarized it fairly well. But we will be looking at what Helen Ziller has said she would do, prioritize, if she became the mayor of Joburg. So we'll have a look at what came out of an interview that was done with her, which should give some indication as to what can be done if the right application is made to performing the necessary task to do it. But big task. We'll also be looking at Al-Qaeda and Islamic State insurgents in West Africa, and really a concern all round that they are, said groups are really achieving a measure of very concerning success. I'm going to have in Gabriel Krauser to talk about public procurement and what's wrong, what we need, BEE, and all those controversial issues one associates with the disaster that often is public sector procurement. And finally, we'll look at the chaos in the Johannesburg property department, particularly in light of a fire that occurred last 2 years ago in the metro building. It's been declared unsafe, but at the in the basement of the building lie most of the documents that prove, you know, plans and of properties around Johannesburg that have to be used when properties are further sold on or bought. So let's just have a quick look at something that, something good has come out of the Madlanga Commission. I'm kind of waiting to get a real sense of the total scope of what comes out at a later stage. I'm not sure I have the bandwidth to follow it all and see. But a funny little thing did come out that is quite pertinent. Deputy Police Minister Kassel Matale had been giving evidence about his boss, Msenzo Mkunu, who's been put on leave pending the outcome of the of this inquiry, of this commission. And he said that neither he nor his fellow deputy, Polly Boshielo, have been assigned duties for months. Now, this is now raised in the public a debate that may have some legs. Do we scrap deputy ministerships? Now, I've no doubt there are obviously deputy ministers who perform a very useful role. But if you think about it, Andrew Whitfield, who was fired from Trade and Industry, hasn't been replaced. There are 43 deputy ministers with 2.2 million rand salaries each, and that excludes perks. And these 43 deputy ministers assist 32 ministers. So the government spends 95 million rand per annum on salaries, and that's before we're looking at the perks of VIP protection, official residences, luxury vehicles, etc. So the question is whether they actually serve no purpose, or whether very few, whether one should just retain the few that do serve a purpose. And you have to ask, in order to serve a purpose, why didn't Cyril Ramaphosa appoint one of the deputies when Mtunu was put on leave to deal with, to run the department, to run police, in his absence? At the same time, he makes the bland statement that deputy ministers play a critical role. But that's the sort of thing he would say. And I think if this has woken us up to nothing else, it's questioning whether we need deputy ministers at all, or in specific environments particularly that just that function is not worth the seat that's being occupied.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
In an interview with Newsday, Helen Ziller was obviously asked about her nomination for the DA's person to be the mayor in Johannesburg. And she essentially blamed Johannesburg's problems on years of entrenched ANC corruption, saying that virtually every service has been sabotaged for the profit of cronies. She did observe that there are honest officials who are appalled at what they see going on, but the risks associated with whistleblowing are absolutely terrifying. And what she wants to do up front is establish a forensic auditing system that encompasses safe systems for reporting corruption in order to protect whistleblowers from retaliation. I know that people desperately want to see those who commit corruption in the government sphere in, as it's often said, orange overalls and convicted for their if their actions is where their actions are criminal. But at the end of the day, I think the biggest punishment for anyone embarking in such heinous action to the detriment of the citizenry need to lose their jobs. I think that's the only thing that will really put a stop to it, whatever other action may be taken. And she says that the priority is that the most corrupt entities have to be examined and cleaned up from top to bottom. And I think it's very important that idea that if you can, and it's not a quick process, and it has to be carefully and thoroughly managed, but you find often in working environments, and these are all working environments, that once you succeed in clearing out, and sometimes it need only be one, maybe two people, but once they are gone, not shifted to somewhere else, but once they are gone, the whole atmosphere within an environment changes, and the productivity of those who have been trying to do a proper job can be considerably uplifted. There's no cost to achieving that. What she intends to do, and this is obviously allied to what we've said, is that she would work closely with the Auditor General to identify weak spots. And she has identified four priority areas: water systems, stabilizing the electricity grid, expanded the sewage network, and detecting leaks, so that the huge percentage of water loss that we experience in and around the city can be saved and dealt with, and thereby reduce the cost of water, the fact that your resource is just being wasted and squandered for no particular purpose. These are not obviously small areas to deal with, but they are the basic areas, and it's about, according to Ziller, annual maintenance, who'd have thought, and capital expenditure on infrastructure. And as a result, funding for the areas that have been mentioned must be ring-fenced. It can't just be moved elsewhere, as the City Council recently did in moving funds needed for water systems and maintenance and repair to other areas. I'm still not entirely sure what the other areas were, but it's the 101 of the management of any environment that money budgeted and provided for a certain service or task must be ring-fenced. Otherwise, you just get, at best, unauthorized expenditure, and at worst, and unfortunately, one thinks most likely, corruption and price gouging. Anyway, she's looking to achieve financial stabilization, and she's going to implement targeted investment in essential services. And this is going to include, to a great extent, collaboration with civil society and the private sector. And she makes a point that I think is that's important, and I think it's Joburg residents deserve kudos for this, and that there is a lot of social capital within what is an active citizenry. And this is a wonderful feature of Johannesburg, and I would agree with her. And I think if there's any sense that who's ever leading the charge in the mayoralty, in the council, can harness the work already done by and could be done by things like ratepayers associations, etc., and bring in the private sector to actually benefit from an investment they would make in the city, which would benefit them and us, it would be an absolutely wonderful thing. So we'll see how that pans out, but the task is going to be big, and her biggest problem, if she is mayor, is heightened expectation, and the lower we sink, the greater our hopes, if not our expectations, will be. Now, to move on to another part of the globe, or rather the continent, is the great concern over Al-Qaeda and Islamic State surging in West Africa and countries like Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. And they're moving then gradually towards Benin, Ivory Coast, Togo, and Ghana. And there's very real concern that Al-Qaeda in particular may win control of Burkina Faso or Mali, and Mali is a particular concern. It's a large country. It's three times the size of California and has 21 million inhabitants. Now, it's not imminent because Al-Qaeda would still have yet to defeat and hold cities, which are much more difficult, much more complex environments. But I think the idea is that they win a war of attrition where eventually the regimes collapse from within. And the blueprint that they are following is very much that of the new leader of Syria and how he took Damascus. So we're facing a situation where these militant jihadist forces have not been stopped by foreign forces from the EU or from the UN. And invariably, the militaries that run many of these countries and have come into power by virtue of coups, etc., can't stop them either. And all what happens is the success of Al-Qaeda and the jihadists put extra pressure, the societies collapse further, and you end up with more military coups, but not more effective. So you've got militaries that can't stop them, civilian governments that have been overthrown, and one can anticipate more. Mali expelled French forces and then resorted to using the Wagner Group, and that saw reprisals and repression that has forced nearly 400,000 Malians into neighboring countries, and the jihadi forces are taxing gold and exporting narcotics. So Africa is still a very, very difficult place to do business.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
The Institute of Race Relations has drafted a alternative public procurement amendment bill that actually sets out what we really need for public procurement to be successful, effective, efficient, cost-effective, not be distracted by a range of unrelated factors. And the person doing all this work is Gabriel Krauser, my fellow of the IRR. And before I get Gabriel to talk about what we should do, Gabriel, let's go to basics. What is public procurement?
Thanks, Sara. So the government spends about 1.2 trillion rand a year buying stuff. Sometimes it's buying laptops for offices. Sometimes it's buying bricks that are going to be used to build school classrooms, although it does that very seldom. Sometimes it's buying bitumen other materials to fill potholes in the road or extend roads. 1.2 trillion rand, for a sense of it, it's about, it's like roughly a seventh of GDP. So it's a little bit like if you think every day of the week, well, there's one day of the week where all of the work, all of the money flow is just the government buying stuff. It's a huge portion of our economic activity. And there's pretty much universal agreement that it's not working out very well. A few years ago, there was a supply chain management review within Treasury, which found that about 40% of public procurement spend is wasted through corruption. And the sort of Treasury established a public procurement office to try and deal with this. And the first thing that it did was try and audit and figure out how much is really being wasted. And then they came up with this 40% figure. And then the then public procurement chief officer was, well, he retired. He says it had nothing to do with the death threats that he was receiving. Subsequently, there hasn't really been an improvement. So while we don't have good data, it does seem like there's massive, massive problems there. And we want to try and just efficientize. We don't have enough money. We had a budget crisis this year. So we can't spend more money. What we have to do is take the money we are spending and spend it better. That's what we're trying to drive here.
Okay. Public procurement tendering has always been associated with the ills of BEE and the extent to which BEE is a criterion for being awarded tenders. Can you just give us some idea of what is required in order to meet racial criteria and why it doesn't meet? On the one hand, you've got goals of creating infrastructure that is for the benefit of everybody, and on the other hand, you've got to have a certain part of your criteria have to be BEE measures. The perception is that ultimately a small number of people have, relatively speaking, have benefited from tendering for public procurement.
Yeah. So just the way it is on paper, the PPPFA, Public Procurement Policy Framework Act, which has been the main law, there are a few laws, but the main one is that one since 2000. It says that if there is a large contract, the cap on a BEE premium is 11.1%. And if there's a contract, it's now 50 million. If the contract's below 50 million, then the cap goes up to 25% on BEE premiums. So BEE premium is, again, you can think about laptops or bricks or wheelie bins or whatever it is that you're buying, medicine. If one company has zero BEE points and the other company has top BEE points, they can be offering exactly the same goods and services, and the company that has more BEE points will be able to charge up to 25% extra and still win the contract. The contract goes to whoever offers the best deal, but those points figure in what counts as the best deal. So they can charge a lot more. Up to 25% more. I think it's important to note we applied pressure in Parliament to try and figure out, you know, how are things really panning out? And the data provided by the DTIC, they've got a database that covers sort of all national tenders. So it doesn't cover the whole 1.2 trillion, but they've said that database is representative, they think, of the whole 1.2 trillion. And on that, they found that 63% of procurement spend was going to majority black-owned businesses. And or almost half was going to 100% black-owned businesses. Now, I think if you were to say, well, maybe the data is not representative, it's going to be in a sense that as you get more down to municipal level, which is what they didn't directly cover, you're even more likely to have majority and 100% black-owned businesses doing the deals, because there it's like it really is these small construction companies that are tendered out to clean the curbs and build little, you know, the new library in a tiny town in rural South Africa. And I think people who are familiar with that construction space will probably agree with my suggestion, although we don't have good data again. Anyway, so the point is that there really are a lot of, the black businesses that are feeding into that supply chain are very well established. It's, you know, this data goes back to 2017. It's pretty stable. So the question is, at this stage, you know, one side is going to say this BEE system has helped these black owned businesses rise up. Another side is going to say, you know, this BEE system actually hurt. It would have been better without the BEE system. The black owned companies would have risen in a growing economy and would have had better opportunities. Richard Mamponya is probably in the latter group, the late great black Soweto capitalist, who said that BEE is actually, it kind of neutralizes the entrepreneurial spirit. Mm. But I don't want to get into that discussion right now. I just want to say, whichever side you're on that debate, we surely should all agree right now that when the vast majority of tenders to the private sector are going to majority black-owned businesses, it no longer makes any sense to be offering black-owned businesses a premium just for being black-owned businesses. Mm. At this stage, we need cost-competitive tendering so that the public that depends on the bridge, the road, the classroom, the effective administrative, the system is down. We can't afford that. Mm. We depend on the system being up. And we depend on the system being up in as cost-effective a way as possible. And that should mean removing BEE premiums.
Right. Well, the DA has recently come up with its own amendment bill, where essentially it offers companies criteria that are not directly related to those that are crucial to providing efficient and effective infrastructure, but based on whether companies can meet United Nations sustainability goals in a range of areas. The idea being that it benefits from the bottom up, so it increases the benefit to the majority of the population rather than confines it to those who've already benefited and are really well established. Those sustainability goals are probably another discussion in themselves and not without controversy as to the extent to which they can be applied. But what for you is the problem with the DA's proposal? And I know that the key to that is that it still impacts hugely on compliance and diverts time, resources and energy to monitoring and following up on criteria that have nothing to do with the original and purpose of a public procurement tender.
Yeah, so let me just say kudos to the DA for trying to phase out race as a criterion. This is not really a new thing for them. That's already been their policy since 2019, but they're drawing attention to it now. That's nice. Obviously, we think that's important. But there's a big problem here. The DA hasn't read the Zondo report. Mm-hmm. The Zondo report, volume one, page 797, 798, 799. The Zondo report analyzes in a systemic fashion the cause of state capture. And basically what it says, to paraphrase, is that when the system is very, very confusing, then it's hard for the procurement officer to decide what is the right contract. It's hard for the auditor to figure out, has the procurement officer done their job properly or not? It's hard for the public to say, is this thing working the way that it's supposed to or not? There's a study by the late Professor Stephen Mejero in Northwest where he found 20% average BEE premiums being spent. So it's very high. If we're spending a fifth of 1.2 trillion rand on BEE premiums, that's crazy. Anyway, I'm not saying it's that, but that's what he found in this particular study. Then he asked the accountants, the procurement officers, are you spending BEE premiums? And half of them said yes, and half of them said no. They're so confused that within the department, they don't even know if they're doing it or not. Mm. So the Zondo report says when it's confusing, then corruption takes over. The DA system is confusing. Mm. They say, in their own words, 80% of the decision-making criteria on their scorecard is value for money stuff. So 30% is price, 20% is like the how well-established is the business or whatever, bunch of things that are going to help big well-established businesses, going to make it harder for new entrants to get in, whatever. Then they say 20% has nothing to do with value for money. It's the UN SDGs. They say there's 231 unique indicators for these social development goals. They give us one example of the SDG points. If you plant trees,
good.
So if you're a laptop selling company, you can maybe get government contracts to sell laptops to the administrators so that they are using your business and you make a profit from that by finding a better deal. You go to Samsung, whatever, HP, and you say like, okay, if we order this kind, we can get a better deal, bit of bulk buying, hana. That way we can offer a better price to the government. That way we'll get the tenders. You can go to that effort to improve your value for money proposition. Or you can plant trees. Now, the effect of planting trees is that's going to count up to 20, that's 20% on the scorecard.
Mm.
So I know it's a Tuesday morning and no one wants to do maths in their head, especially when they're listening to the radio, but let's just do a small mathematical equation. Price is 30% on the BE scorecard and SDG goals is 20%. Mm. So think about this, two companies, they're alike in all ways, but one of them charges double the price. That means the cheap one gets 30 points and the one that's charging double gets 15 points. You halve it, it's pro rata. That means 15 points there, the expensive one is losing 15 points. Oh, what are we gonna do? Well, we're gonna plant some trees. What do we get for that? 20 points. Mm. So they can plant trees and charge twice as much for laptops and win the contract against another company that's just charging. They're like, here's what we want to do as a laptop selling company. We're going to charge half the price and not plant trees, not donate to charity, not do anything else. We're going to put all our effort into charging half the price. They're going to lose. So the DA system, the current system has a price cap of 25%. The DA system has a price cap of like 260%.
Mm.
It's, I don't think they've thought it through, honestly. Mm. If they have, it's I think they should think again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a sweet intention there to step away from race, but they have got a confusing system that allows massive premiums that has even more burdensome potential duties imposed on procurement officers, which, as the Zonda report says, never mind just the price premium that I did with the math there, the capacity for boosting corruption by having this very complicated system being put in place, you have to think to yourself, in the Northwest, where Professor Stephen Mejero went, where, you know, the literacy rate in the procurement office is not exactly a Harvard PhD.
Mm.
You know, there are good people there. There are nice people there. But there are people who have had to go through not a great education system. It's confusing. It's difficult work already to try and maximize value for money. Now you need to ask these people to deal with SDG goals on top of it. It's a worrying prospect.
So the draft legislation that you've authored, what should we be doing?
Maximize value for money. Ours is called the Value for Money Bill. That's what you focus on. The way to, you know, the way to win is focus on winning.
Mm.
So there are a few provisions that we provide for, but one of them is we say that the sole determining factor, not 80%, not 60%, not 30%, the sole determining factor of every contract awarded must be maximum value for money. Then we've gone to international public procurement best practice kind of conventions and looked at what they say is the way to think about that. It's not just price. You can't just buy the cheapest thing because, I mean, if you look at some RDP houses, the government bought the cheapest bricks and then 10 years later, the house has already fallen down. Right. It would have made more sense to spend an extra 40% on good bricks that are going to last 50 years, 100 years than to get cheap ones. So you have to look, the first thing is look over the life cycle of the goods or services that you're purchasing, not just at the moment of purchase, what is the value?
Mm.
And we apply those kinds of international best practice accounting principles to figure out how to do maximum value for money. And then we say, don't do anything else. That is a very, very simple approach. We have, I'll add one more sort of simpler, better, faster is a bit the motto.
Mm-hmm.
One of the crucial things is that big businesses can survive when the government takes long to pay them because they have very easy overdraft relationships with banks. They've got deep reserves that give them liquidity. They don't face problems there. Little businesses that deal with the government have a problem when the government doesn't pay on time. Now, Treasury has, to its credit, introduced regulations that require it to pay within 30 days. And together with removing Tom Moyani from SARS and after the Nugent Commission, re-looking at how VAT rebates are issued, the issue is not nearly as bad as it was in 2018, but it remains a bit of an issue. The international best practice is to introduce a system of e-invoicing. And e-invoicing can be, the standard internationally is that you pay that in 5 days once you've got a valid e-invoice, rather than 30 days once you've got a paper invoice, which is really emailed. So it's already electronic, but it's not through a centralized system. So if you let a system, you have this kind of transparent digital system, you require that, then the government has to pay within 5 days. That means small businesses will have an easier time dealing with the government. They'll be more eager to opt in. That will increase competition. That will push the price down. It's good for business. It's good for the taxpayer. It's good for the poor person who's relying on the services. And that feeds into our digital repository. We say every decision that has been made, the tender, when it goes out, has to say, how are we going to evaluate value for money? And the decision has to say, why does this maximize value for money? That gets put in a digital repository that's accessible to the press, so that if there is some dispute about a particular contract, if someone is making some ridiculous decision, oh, I think planting trees is adding value for money when it comes to a laptop or something, the press can get hold of that and make an issue about it. So you use civil society, which is established, you use its advantages to also drive the price down, drive the quality up. So the digital repository, e-invoicing, and sole focus at the point of decision making on maximum value for money, those are kind of the three legs of the stool that I think really stands up to the task of improving bang for buck with our 1.2 trillion.
Right. Finally, Gabriel, I mean, it seems like what's happened is the whole idea of BEE as it was formulated decades ago has displayed, well, not only has it been an option at the forefront of the ability of government and those associated with those who govern us to commit corruption, but it shows it's also that prevents us from just being much more creative about BEE and the fact that procurement, By the very virtue of getting things built, your library, your bridge, or TARD, your road, that in and of itself is a benefit. To the more broadly it can be done, the more money there is available to do it, that in itself has a benefit. But also just that BEE, there are a myriad of ways of dealing with disadvantage that just don't get don't get out from under the sort of lure of corruption.
So, yeah, I mean, the term BEE to me, and I think to most South Africans, is always going to be, what does BEE mean? BEE means laws that pick winners and losers in whether it's procurement, labor, investment, those three, picks winners and losers based on race. I'm not going to try and save that term. We're not trying to save BEE. Okay. What we are trying to save here is transformation.
Yeah.
South Africa had to transform. We were in apartheid. That was a nightmare. We had to transform out of that. Now, the last 15 years, since I matriculated high school in 2007, we have not grown economically at all. GDP per capita, real wealth per capita, is the same level as it was back then. We need to transform again. We need to transform from a stagnant redistributive economy to a growing economy where wealth and income increases. And that is going to have that's the only way to bring down unemployment. That's the only way to do poverty alleviation. And maximum value for money procurement is a key ingredient to that, because it means immediately poor people who depend disproportionately on government services are going to get more services. There are more classrooms being built, there's more roads being extended into the rural hinterland and so on, more libraries. And at the second, and electricity, more capacity. We haven't had load shedding for a while, but you need electricity capacity to increase. Okay, at a second order, the thing that follows from better service delivery is more gross fixed capital formation. When government sees, when the private sector sees that the government is no longer talking about public-private partnerships, but is instead doing the work that the public sector is supposed to do, then the private sector says, this is exciting. Because you know what happens in countries where infrastructure is actually improving and being maintained, where the state is spending its money effectively? We can invest in those countries and get return on our investment. We can get growth on our investment. You attract investment by doing your own job properly. So far in South Africa, we've had this kind of panicked attitude. And I think the DA's thing is also a bit panicked, where everyone's trying to do everything all at once. You want the public procurement officer not only to get the cheapest laptop for the best deal on the laptop. You also want him to think about the environment and planting trees, or school feeding programs or whatever it is. And likewise, you want business to constantly be thinking not just about their own return on investment, but how can they be socially friendly? And you want the government to think, the system we recommend has division of labor. Adam Smith had it going hundreds of years ago. You really get things efficient when some people specialize in their tasks. So the procurement officer specializes in getting maximum value for money. The private sector then sees this. They specialize in getting return on investment. The public gets the benefit of real increases in service delivery and job opportunities and material outcomes. That's the concoction we're looking for. And eventually, in 15, 20 years, I think it is realistic that you can get Indian levels of growth of 8% right. a year in a democracy like ours.
Gabriel, I'm sorry to have to stop you there. We're pushing for time. But thank you very much for joining us. Much appreciated as ever. And we'll see you soon.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, we're in a situation where developers can't build, homeowners can't sell, and banks are refusing jobs. Oh, sorry, bonds. That's a Freudian slip. All because Joburg, the city, cannot find its own building plans. Now, in the middle of September 2023, the main metro building of the municipality caught a light and went up in flames and has been lying there declared unstable, unsafe. So we're now in this situation where you can't access plans that are under the basement of the building. And the city of Johannesburg has had problems recently to get its digital land service systems back online. So essentially, much of the property market is paralyzed by a combination of sort of collapse of those very systems that were procured in the form of computers, and millions of missing physical building plans, which are still locked in the basement. They estimate that about 2 million records have been sealed off as unsafe. So what should be a routine request, literally email, telephone conversation, please may I come and obtain copies of X, they can't be found. No one's going into the building. And what you're finding is homeowners are losing sales. Contracts are being rewritten. Banks are refusing bonds because plans cannot be retrieved. So architects are sort of redrawing what they call as built plans for up to 100,000 rand a set, depending on the size of the building. And of course, what's in true South African style, what has happened is it's created a syndicates, underground market, where they literally slip into the metro center, into the basement, despite apparent security, retrieve the plans, and then sell them to the people who are asking for plans. And the whole issue of providing identity and collecting plans has fallen away. And inevitably, you're going to end up with unsafe construction and additions and fraud, and these plans which may be sold to interested buyers disappear forever. It is apparently the obligation of everyone to be responsible for their own individual plans, but I very much doubt whether most property owners have copies of their own plans until they need them for one or other purposes. And of course, there are very few building inspectors in Joburg to check new additions and alterations, so it's essentially a free-for-all. So it is hampered property buying and selling transactions completely and utterly, and it costs between 50 and 75,000 and easily over 100,000 for double-story homes to replace missing plans. So you're not just looking at the cost of renovation, but you've got to add on this amount for providing plans that can justify the build. And it can even relate to just structural changes like converting a garage to an office or adding a swimming pool, et cetera, et cetera. And it just makes, literally, it creates a sense of paralysis. There's also other elements that one hadn't thought of and raised by the Johannesburg Heritage Foundation, which warned that archives include irreplaceable records dating back to the city's foundings, and which are a priceless civic resource. And they are vulnerable to the damp, the fire, the vandalism, the syndicate theft, etc. And leaving the plans in that building, and all I can say is there must be some way. I understand the state of the building and the unsafety, but there must be some way, and some way within the last 2 years, to have managed the removal of at least some, if not all, of the. Of all of the plans. If the bad guys can do it, surely the good guys can do it as well. So, you know, it's the Joburg the Joburg department is just everything that's wrong with this country writ large.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Just to return to the investigation into the allegations about the relationship between the high levels of the police and shady operators in the business world, we've got the Madlanga Commission, which we spoke about earlier. But I think what the government has probably, and what Cyril Ramaphosa has completely underestimated, is the Parliamentary Ad Hoc Committee investigation into the claims made by Lieutenant General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi. There are two reasons for this. One is that this committee has to reach conclusion very much more quickly than the Madlanga Commission. So it may or may not go into the depth and extent of the Madlanga Commission, which is going to cost us hundreds of millions of rands anyway, as these commissions usually do. But the problem for the government with the Parliamentary Ad Hoc Committee is that the people sitting on those committee are not just ANC committee members, but they are representatives from the DA and other opposition parties, whether they're in the Government of National Unity or not. And that has led to a much greater level of robust questioning and challenging of witnesses that have come before the ad hoc committee. And I think it is the unintended consequences of trying to save your backside by putting in place the Madlanga Commission, which is long drawn out and confusing, and I don't know if it will entirely know what comes out until the commissioners have actually reached a decision in this regard. But the spectacle of the ad hoc committee draws much more rapid and knowledgeable fire from the participants of the committee, who can really tackle the contradictions and the gaps that get presented by the various members, various witnesses who come forward and can be subpoenaed to come forward to the Parliamentary Ad Hoc Committee. So I think it's the very process itself, while intended to kick the whole furore around Mkhwanazi's allegations, in the lead up to the local elections, the ANC conference in 2027 and the next national election in 2029, are going to be fundamental to further sinking the ANC's chances of ever being anything but a minority, and maybe not even the largest minority, the largest party in the coalition of minority parties that we are likely to face for the next few decades. So there's a thought that, you know, when you, if you go and put it out in public, it's going to get into the public and be interpreted as such. So good luck to them. I commend you to my modest little Substack, which is also called Sara Gone Rogue, where you can find it at sara281.substack.com, which deals with a whole range of issues that I believe people, personally, that I believe people may be interested in. including things as broad-ranging as, not necessarily South African politics, but issues like anti-Semitism in general. And otherwise, I ask you to join me next week when we'll again be looking at everything that is politics. Keep well.